These days, he works for the Senate when they need him. The rest of the time, he sleeps, he drinks, he showers. Occasionally. Singier says, "And here I thought I had a problem. At least I don't wake up smelling like I've been brining in my own grief sweat for 3 days. I mean, I think we need to face the delicious irony that right now I am sober as a vicar, and you're the one sauced to the gills."
"Go back to where you came from."
"The Empire? I think that job prospect is soon on its way to extinction. In fact, that's why I'm here."
"I'm done fighting the Empire."
"Perhaps you are, but Jazz is not."
"Jazz? Jazz can do what she wants,"
Jom grumbles. "That much is abundantly clear. She did you, after all." That last bit spoken with trademark singier cheek. Jom should punch him, but every time he moves, his head feels like an aquarium whose glass is being wrapped by a bratty child. "And yet, Jazz needs your help."
"Then she should have come here herself."
"Maybe she would have. Oh, I don't know, if she wasn't trapped on Jakku, with no hope of rescue."
"Jakku?"
That name bubbles up out of the septic murk that is presently his memory. He cares little to follow the news, but some news is so big it follows you. And you couldn't go anywhere nowadays without hearing how the Empire is there on Jakku, could you? Wait, Jazz is on Jakku?
"Why? Why is she there?"
"She and Nora, took an unscheduled escape pod ride down to the surface, and now we have no way to extract them." Jom lurches to his feet. He kicks around the trash on his floor looking for a shirt or pants or something.
"Then what are we doing standing around?"
He suddenly erps into his hand, choking back vomit.
"Standing around here. Find me my blaster and some clothes. Let's go get her."
"It's not that easy." Jom turns on him and thrusts a calloused finger up into the ex-Imperial's face.
"It is that easy. It's always that easy."
"Not this time," Singier says, his tone dire. "Surrounding that planet is the entire Imperial remnant. One imagines it's like a Kiva. A total occupation, except this is 10 times worse than a Kiva. 100 times! Jom, we don't even know if Jazz and Nora are alive down there. What we do know is if we have any shot here, that means hitting the Empire hard as we can. And to do that, we need a resolution to engage them. We need to finish this war."
"I'm afraid that's above my pay grade, Singier."
"But it isn't. I have a plan."
Jom scratches his unshorn face. The mustache and chops he used to keep neatly trimmed have grown into a scraggly shrub on his cheeks and chin.
"You have a plan? This ought to be rich."
"It is. You work for the Senate now, correct?"
"I work the security pool, yeah."
"Good. How do you feel about Nakadia this time of year?"
Chapter 19. Senator Tolwar Wartol's yacht is a Ganoidian tri-deck cruiser. Spare in its design, it is far from a luxury craft. Everything is hard angles and flat surfaces. The front end of the ship looks like a set of steps. Most of the vessel is boxy in some parts, knife-like in others. Presently it sits docked at the Senate hangar. It is one of the last ships remaining, the rest already having gone to Nakadia, where the Senate will now convene. The cruiser's engines are cycling, and harbor crew perform all the proper cross-checks. A droid disconnects a fueling hose from the tailport. Wartol does not expect her, and so it is the perfect time to strike. Before the ramp can be raised, Mon Mothma marches forward. A diligent woman of purpose, flanked by 2 plume-helmeted guards, and storms right on board the ship. Wartol's own guards
all Orishin, attempt to stand in her way, crossing pikes in front of her. She sneers at them, undaunted.
Do you think that's wise? One suspects the senator will be disappointed to learn that his guards cost him a measure of popularity because they turned the chancellor of the new republic away through the threat of violence.
Frankly, she suspects that at this point, turning her away might earn him a bump in popularity. But the bluff works. Their nose slits twitch and pucker as they pull their pikes away. She steps aboard. Wartol stands nearby in a sitting area, and it gives her a bit of joy to find him startled by her presence. He quickly turns away from the viewport, like a naughty child caught spying on a neighbor. He regains his composure a moment later, and the victory is small, but right now Mon Mothma takes whatever edge she can get.
Chancellor, he says.
His voice is a booming drum in the well of his chest. It has a rich vibrato to it, a doomed music.
Apologies, I was lost in thought, and I did not expect you.
Odd, given that I've been trying to pin you to a meeting for the last week.
She smiles stiffly.
Things, as you know, have been rather busy.
You're not busy now. I will join you on your trip to Nakadia. We can enjoy the journey together, Senator. Does that sound all right?
Do I have a choice?
Her icy smile is unswerving.
Not an easy one.
With a gesture of his long-fingered hand, his own guards disappear from the room. She dismisses her own protectors accordingly. The sitting room is spare. Everything is as boxy inside the ship as it is outside. The chairs are hard enamel. The viewports are tall and topped with telescoping steel shutters. The floor is cold. The room contains no fabric, no softness, nothing to endear you to it. It is as unwelcoming as a brick. Like Wartol, in a way. Still, she sits when he offers her a chair. It isn't comfortable, exactly, but she admits that the rigidity of it suits her. Wartol takes his seat across from her. He lifts a bowl off a nearby table as he hands it to her. Hard, osseous little sockets rattle around inside it. They look like knuckle bones. In each is a bit of yellow flesh, dried and dusted. It's food, she thinks.
Nectards,
he says.
Little pod creatures that form on the sides of our ships, filtering in whatever microfauna they can eat. They survive the vacuum of space. They're quite tough, but you marinate them and roast them slowly over low heat, and they become a snack.
Mon has politely eaten the food of countless species. Decorum demands it, and she does not disappoint here either. She takes one of the bony bits and turns it over in her hand again and again. He instructs her to place it to her lips and suck the meat out of its center, which she does. She expects it to taste, well, bad, fishy or mealy or fungal. But it is oddly refreshing. A citrus tang and salty wave hit her tongue. He eats one too. Wartol does not look at his food as he eats, though. The X-shaped irises of his deep-set eyes stare at Mon, as if dissecting her. The corneas drift and pulse. It's almost hypnotizing. His regal, deep voice and his kaleidoscopic eyes give her a sense of why he's so popular. That, and he carries the invisible mantle of leadership. It fits him well.
He could win this thing, you know. What would you do if he did? Where would you go? What role would you serve, Mon?
Outside, the clang of the fueling hose decoupled from the ship jars her from her poisonous thoughts. The engines hum to life, and the ship begins to lift.
I cannot imagine this is a pleasure visit,
Wartol says.
It is not.
It's certainly unorthodox.
I don't think so. Is it strange for a chancellor to want to speak to one of her senators?
A senator who opposes her in the election, you mean?
She smiles. Surely, despite the election, we have shared interests. We both want the best for the galaxy, do we not?
The Orishan's lower jaw splits, and his tapered pink tongue licks along the serrated teeth on each side.
There's no audience here, Chancellor. We're not in the Senate House. Jettison this masquerade and speak plainly. What is it you want, and why are you here?
The resolution to attack the Empire's fleet on Jakku.
The one that failed, you mean?
The vote failed to pass by 5 votes. Just 5.
He discards an empty nectod shell into the bowl. The ship shudders as it enters atmosphere, and soon thereafter all of space and time seem to slide out from under them as the ship launches into hyperspace. Wartol shrugs.
That's how it happens sometimes, as you know. Votes fail. Sometimes by 1, sometimes by 1,000. Not that the Senate is that big yet to have 1,000 votes, but it will be. When I am Chancellor, new worlds will return to us.
As you say, there's no audience here, so you don't need to sell me on your candidacy. I want to talk about those 5 senators. Senators Ashmeen Ek, Rethalo, Dor Waido, Gwelka Sorka, and Nimtar. 5 senators, all of whom have voted with you in the past. 5 senators who have worked with you across various councils and caucuses. And yet, while you voted for intervention with the Empire, they did not.
He frowns.
They are not automatons.
No, but they do take their cues from you.
They did not this time, it seems.
And yet, you have not gone out of your way to convince them. The revote is tomorrow.
She's fortunate. Present rules allow for her to plead her case anew, further allowing for a revote. That is due to the fact that the margin of failure was particularly narrow. Under 10 votes separating the outcomes allows for the mechanism of a revote to trigger automatically. After this, no such mechanism will save her. No such revote will come into play, which means she needs to nullify those 5 votes.
Why would you stand in the way of the progress you so desire, exactly? Why not chase it down? You have sway with these senators. Use it.
As you note, I voted for your resolution, Chancellor. I want this over with as much as you do. The Empire must fall.
So, I ask for your help to convince those senators,
Mon says.
Help you? Liberation Day really did rattle your head, didn't it?
She leans forward.
And here I thought you said you wanted this over with as much as I do. Apparently not. You're quite the politician. Happy to cast away your principles in favor of a victory.
If you say so.
Let me paint a picture.
She begins coldly.
You know that my resolution failing to pass is a mark against me. It reflects a failure of leadership on my part. And so you convince 5 senators to vote against the resolution, while you protect yourself by voting in favor of it. That way, I cannot easily call you out, lest I look conspiratorial.
Conspiratorial indeed.
You've laid your principles on an altar and sacrificed them.
Now Wartol brings the heat to his voice. His jaw bisects, and his tongue ripples.
You do not get to speak to me about sacrifice, Chancellor. Orish knows sacrifice. Orish knows what it is to poison ourselves so that the Empire may not consume us and our world. What do you know of it? The Empire never quite made its way to Chandrila, did it?
Yes, but I made my way to the Empire. I fought them. I lost people.
But you didn't lose your world. You had the privilege of pursuing this fight. My people had no such privilege. The fight came to us. They enslaved us. I watched them shackle us and beat us and begin strip mining our world, pilfering its resources. Our place, our people, all held under the Empire's thumb. Until we found a way to wriggle free.
And I would never dismiss the perseverance of your people.
Dismiss it? No. You'd simply squander it. You don't know what it takes. I and the other Orishin are masters of sacrifice. We know its value. We know how to wield it.
Is that what this is, then? Sacrifice?
Mon asks.
You will throw our war efforts away for your own conquest of the New Republic? The sacrifice of oneself can be noble, Senator, but the sacrifice of the safety of a whole galaxy? That is an attack on us all, and I cannot abide it.
He stands up, looming over her. She tries not to show that she feels the threat of his presence. He could crush her quite easily. She could be dead, jettisoned into space, and that would be that.
You don't get to tell me that. You don't have the right. Perhaps the truth of a thing is that I feel a republic with you at its helm is the greatest concern.
He seethes.
You are weak. Your leadership is spineless and indulgent. Liberation Day shows the truth of that.
You did do it. You sabotaged the vote.
Wartol does not sit back down, so much as he falls backward against the chair. He looks away from her as he says, almost dismissively,
I admit to nothing. I will not give life to your conspiratorial fancies.
Then let me try a new conspiracy.
She opens her hand and lets a small device clatter across it. The device has a pinhole mic at its top, and from its bottom, a squid tangle of severed wires. He barely glances at it.
What is that?
You know what it is. It is a listening device. A bug.
So you say?
You planted it.
That is a heady accusation. I assume it comes with proof.
He waves her off, his hand then closing into a fist.
Oh, no, it doesn't. Just another baseless allegation from the besieged Mon Mothma.
You knew. You knew that the Empire was at Jakku. You knew that two of our own were going to take the Millennium Falcon to that world. And you stopped them. Oh, the guards wouldn't admit it was you, and they tried to claim it was me who stopped the Falcon. But they listened to you. You have authority. You have your little feelers everywhere, don't you?
You can prove none of that.
That is correct. I cannot. So I'll have to do it the old-fashioned way. By beating you to a bloody pulp.
Her eyes flash with mischief.
In the election, I mean.
Good luck with that, Chancellor. Your precious re-vote is in the morning. Less than 12 hours away. We land soon. I hope you scramble the votes you need, but time is ever dwindling.
She smiles.
If only there was some way to delay the vote.
You should be so lucky.
The ship jolts as it comes out of hyperspace. Outside the viewport, the blue lines shorten to pinpricks, and once more they're in the deep well of space. But from here, she can see the crescent edge of the world upon which the new Senate is housed, Nakadiya.
Beautiful world, Nakadiya,
she says. Tolwar Wartol grunts in reply.
Interesting fact about Nakadiya,
she continues.
We liberated them from the Empire, and now they provide a great deal of the food for our troops. Something about the soil composition. It's just right to grow a variety of vital crops. It's a pristine environment, with a huge food yield for us. The vote to make it a Class A protected planet, well, that was an easy vote. You voted yes. We all did. We came together on that one.
History lessons are most effective when they are interesting,
he says.
And this does not pass the test, Chancellor.
I'm sorry to bore you. I thought it interesting.
The door to the sitting room opens. A narrow-shouldered Orishin stands there. Not a guard, but a pilot in gold and red with his helmet on, his visor up.
Senator, we have a problem.
Wartol looks to the pilot, then to the Chancellor, then back to the pilot. He is suspicious now. Good. He should be.
What is it?
Nakadia isn't allowing us to land, Senator.
And why would that be?
They're saying that preliminary scans indicate we are host to a restricted agricultural product, potentially invasive.
Wartol turns to her. He already suspects that she did something. And of course, he's right.
Chancellor, what did you do?
A statement, not a question. She fakes embarrassment as she pulls out a small, palm-sized fruit from within her robes.
Oh, my, my, my. Look at that. A little putta fruit, already half-squished.
She pulls her thumb away from the inside of her index finger. The sap leaking from the punctured skin of the dark orange fruit is brown and sticky and nearly glues her thumb to her finger. Seeds glom onto the glop. What's important, however, is not the seeds or the glop, but rather the off-gassing fragrance, one that the ship's own environmental sensors would have picked up. And Nakadian off-world scanners do a passive reading of every ship's own sensors as they pass through. Which means those sensors would have picked up.
The pitta is restricted on Nakadia, isn't it? They'll have to do a full sweep of the ship and scan for other contaminants. Oh my, I fear this will cause us quite a delay. Don't you, Senator?
Chapter 20. The magic number is 5. 5 spies for 5 senators. The secret hope is this. The 5 senators voting against intercession against the Empire are corrupt. There exists a tiny glimmer of evidence toward that end. Condor sliced, not quite legally, into the electronic ledgers of those senators' accounts. And in 2 of them, he found unusual credit deposits of unidentifiable origin. Those 2 senators, Ashmin Ek of Anthen Prime and Dor Waido of Rhodia. That, in and of itself, is not much. In this time of waning empire and a rising new republic, certain investments are paying off well. The markets are volatile as old industries collapse and new corporations come online. And where there is volatility, there are people getting surprisingly and suddenly rich. That, though, coupled with the fact of a listening device found inside Leia's protocol droid, they discuss it on board the Falcon, in orbit above Nakadia.
Where there's smoke, there's usually fire,
Solo says, before adding quietly,
usually an electrical fire near the hyperspace drive, which Chewie always warns me about.
He stops talking, looking lost in his own head. Condor jumps in and says,
Solo's right. There might be something here.
We follow the smoke, Singier says. We find the fire.
Only then will they find something to help them get the votes to send the New Republic to Jakku, he explains. But they're running out of time. Nakadia. It's an agricultural world. Broad fields, orchards, pastures. The sky has a violet tinge to it, even at the peak of day. And at night, the 2 moons brighten the dark. The air is often warm, like bathwater, with just a faint breeze. It's pastoral. Some would even say backward. The cities are small. The towns are villages.
There's tech, but it all goes to the function of farming, for aerating soil, for injecting micronutrients, for harvesting. The capital city is Quaro, and it's where the Senate will be housed for the next year's cycle, and maybe more if the Senate votes to extend its stay. Quaro is a city of only a few thousand. No building is taller than 3 stories. The Fibercrete streets are for biologicals only. No speeders, no machines, no droids. In fact, the planet has something of a bias against droids. It uses them where necessary, but generally it is the Nakadians themselves who work the soil and tend to the crops. Nakadia has a long memory, and it remembers the waves of droids that occupied it during the Clone Wars. It accepts these machines, but Nakadians do not treat them as equal, or even as sentient. Quaro is a city with little nightlife. Frankly, it is a city with little daylife as well. It has restaurants and taverns, yes. It has one Poma Club, where you can go and sit in a deprivation chamber as throbbing pulse music massages your every molecule. Those chambers are filled with bubbling Poma, a fluid derived from the seeds of the inedible Poma droop fruit. It relaxes the muscles. It releases the mind. Some hallucinate a little. The next day, they return to the fields, freshly invigorated and freed of what they call psychological baggage. There's little crime, there's little drama. There's little anything, really. Life on Nakadia is not easy, but it has an easy lean to it. Simplicity is king. And so the challenge for the 5 spies is this. How exactly will they capture any of the 5 senators in wrongdoing when everything is so simple, so untainted by corruption, so boldly out in the open? Night on Nakadia. Tomorrow morning, the Senate is primed for its first session here on the planet. But right now, Quaro is alive with the kind of life it has not seen, probably ever. It's not just that there are now 327 senators encroaching on the quiet city. It's that those senators also come with their own entourages. Droids, advisors, attachés, siblings, children, mates, and lovers. Ships clog the docks. Hana City on Chandrilla was ready for what was to come. Quaro on Nakadia is not. It is a logistical logjam. And one by one, senators disgorge from their vessels, tainting this very nice world with a smug and indulgent cloud of politics and government. That, at least, is how Singier feels about all of it. Presently, he is assigned to watch Ashmeen Ek of Anthon Prime. They wouldn't be here if it weren't for Jom. Here, the only ones allowed on site are senators, their staff members, their security, and those who petitioned for the exception list. Those on that list of exceptions might include journos, celebrities, certain business barons who want to press the flesh and try to encourage industry-friendly policies. Thing is, that list is curated months in advance. The slots are limited and have been full since it opened. Yes, Mon Mothma or Leia probably could have pulled the strings to get their names on the list, but doing so would have been an obvious gesture, and one that connects what she's doing on Wartol's cruiser to their efforts down here on Nakadia. The Chancellor wisely did not want any threads connecting her to them, lest this all blow up in their faces. That's where Jom came in. Jom, now working as security, was willing to, adjust the list. He knocked off a handful of questionable journalists and added their names to it instead. Solo and Singier were easy. Both count roughly as celebrities among the most narcissistic of politicians. Solo as a bona fide hero of the rebellion, and Singier as a freakish curiosity. Oh, look, at the funny Imperial. Gasp. Did he know Darth Vader? Condor has worked for senators before, so he too was a value add for the list. Temin was tougher to get on, but they used his nickname, Snap, and put him down as a military veteran, and nobody looked askance. So now they wait, and they watch. It is predictably dull work. Across from the Quaro Senate House sits a restaurant, Izix. It's mostly outdoors, and underlit tables populate a trio of staggered hovering patios. Senators crowd around them, elbow to elbow, shoulder to shoulder, tentacle to eye stalk, gassily congratulating one another on their debatable achievements. Laughing and lightly applauding. And now the tentacled senator from Torfless is gurgling something that may be a song or maybe a cry for help. And there's more laughter and more applause. Eck, for his part, is a mover and a shaker. Some sit in one place, dropping an anchor at a table and hanging tight in little clicks. But the Anthon Prime Senator is a veritable social pollinator, flitting from political flower to political flower, and sprinkling a bit of himself on everyone. He's like a droid on a program. He says the same things, makes the same sounds, offers the same congratulations, bellows the same laughs at the same times. None of it is untoward. It's all entirely above board. That worries Sinjir, because right now they're looking for something that may not be there. The simplest answer is almost always the truest. And here the simplest answer is that the five senators who voted against Mon Mothma's resolution did so because they are politicians. They have agendas, and those agendas needn't line up with the safety of the galaxy. Oh, sure. It's lovely to believe everyone has the best interests of the greater good at heart. But to seek power, to want a hand helping steer the galaxy's fate, is an act of ultimate ego. It is an act of self, no matter how selfless one portrays it. Which means there is likely no conspiracy here, except the all-too-common conspiracy of aggressive self-interest. As Sinjir slowly orbits Senator Eck, winding his way surreptitiously through the crowd of shudder politicians, he spies a familiar face across the uppermost patio. Condor. Condor smirks. Coy, boyish, playful, that monster. Sinjir ignores him, or tries to. He leans back against the bar, and gently speaks into the comlink at his wrist. No good news to report.
I got good news,
Solo says through Sinjir's earpiece. Han isn't here. He's at the northernmost spaceport just outside Quaro, where Senator Dor Waido from Rhodia remains in his ship. Solo's enough of a known quantity in the New Republic that putting him somewhere too public like Izix is a good way to gum up the works. Everyone would be stopping the hero of the rebellion, fawning over him, asking him about Luke, about Leia, about that damn Kessel run he likes to go on about.
Mon's plan worked. I just heard it from one of the stevedores on break. Wartol's ship is being held out of queue in quarantine while they wait for an inspection crew to come aboard. It'll be a while, but I don't know that it buys us much time. 12 hours at best. And I never like to expect the best.
We're not going to find anything, Sinjir says.
Jom's turn to talk.
We need to Criffing find something.
He's watching Rethalo of Frong at one of the Poma clubs.
I still don't understand why we can't just go up, knock these traitors on the head, and ask them what they're up to. Sinjir, you can do that. Tell them to vote how we like, or they'll have to listen to you drone on about whatever it is you like to drone on about. That'd be real torture.
A laugh over the comlink. Condor. Condor's here at Izix, watching Nimtar, the bobble-headed Quirmian. That long-necked senator sits off in the far corner, nervously nursing some kind of fruit drink, and looking like he doesn't want to be here at all.
Patience,
Condor says.
Night's still young. I'm still young, too,
Temin says. He's the last of them, and he's across from the Senate House on a balcony, keeping an eye on Grelka Sorka, the senator from Askage. She's already busy working, running some committee about, well, Sinjir forgets what. Probably a committee designated to give themselves pay raises, or a committee designed to design other committees. Temin groans.
I'm young now, but I feel myself getting older by the minute. This sucks vapor. I hate it.
Sinjir wants to chide the boy. It is necessary, Temin. But that's a line he's not even sure he buys. He wants to do what they all want to do. Grab the Falcon, fly to Jakku, blow up the Empire single-handedly, and save Nora and Jazz as an epic, heroic gesture. Except they can't. They'll get killed. Or start a galactic incident and end up getting Wartol elected anyway. So, here they wait, watching senators in the hope that at least one of them is visibly corrupt in a way to provide them with enough leverage to win the vote. Hours pass. Nothing happens. At least nothing interesting. At Izzix, the Torflusian tentacle pile is still singing. Two Verpine advisors got into a loud argument at a table, chittering and rubbing their saw blade arms together. The resultant sound made Sinjir want to puncture both of his eardrums with a toothpick. And now those same two Verpine are leaning over a different table, lustily rubbing their mouth parts together. Otherwise, it's the same glad-handing, back-scratching crowd of politicos. Ashmeen Ek is tireless. Other senators have gone, their numbers replenished as the night goes on. But not Ek. The senator from Anthon Prime remains. The same plastic smile on his face, the same half-full drink in his hand, the same time spent whirling about. The others aren't having any luck either. Dor Waido remains in his ship. Rethalo remains inside its Poma Club depth tank. Temin reports that Grelka Sorka is no longer in committee and is now outside the Senate House, just milling about. Nimtar has loosened up a little bit and has left the safety of her corner table, moving one table over to talk to the young Ryloth emissary, Yendor. Sinjir spies Condor hovering about in that direction. Every time he catches that glimpse, his heart rate picks up. His mouth goes wet. His throat gets tight. He tells himself it's because he's bored or anxious or not properly drunk enough. Which is to say, not drunk at all. A heinous mistake if ever there was one. Night drifts toward the cliff's edge of morning. And then Solo says,
I got something here.
A flurry of questions. What? Who? Where?
Couple of Nikto, plus a Klaatuwinian. They're headed toward Waido's ship. They're not armed, but they sure don't look like they're from Nakadiya. And neither could be senators. I know scum when I see it. Be careful,
Jom says over the comm.
Relax, I got this,
Han says. Now Sinjir's blood is up. It's probably nothing, but his skin prickles with the twin sensations of excitement and fear. He roots himself near the bar and keeps an eye out. There's Ek over by a table of Arconans, and approaching now is someone in the gold, red, and white of Alderaan. Did they finally elect a senator, even though the planet is destroyed? A nail of guilt sticks in Sinjir's heart. He had literally nothing to do with the destruction of that planet. But even still, when he heard that the Empire had destroyed it, he had weeks of nightmares about it. Millions of people dying? A hand grabs his elbow. He tenses up like an animal about to strike, spinning heel to toe, only to see a young woman standing there. A young man hurries up behind her. She has golden hair and bronze skin. He's a bit shorter, with a body thin as an antenna, but a head round as a moon.
You're him,
she says.
And you're her,
Sinjir answers, irritated.
Glad we got that out of the way. Now, if you'll excuse me...
You're the Imperial,
the young man says, beaming.
Ex-Imperial,
she corrects with a very temporary scowl before her big smile returns. To Sinjir, she says in a low voice,
You'll have to excuse Dan. He's a bit thick. My name is Mara.
Yes, good, fine. Nice to meet you.
In his ear comes Temin's voice.
Hold on. Senator Sorka's slipping away. She's ducking around the corner. I'm gonna follow her.
Be careful,
Jom chides.
Han, you got anything?
But there's no answer.
Sinjir tries to push past the two wide-eyed wonder children standing there, but the girl reasserts herself in front of him, blocking his path.
We're Akivans,
Mara says excitedly.
Our mother, Paima Drolli, is the newly appointed senator here.
Lovely,
Sinjir says. He lifts his eyes above them, expecting to see Ashmeen Ek with the Arkona contingent. But they're there alone, with the Alderaanian woman. Ek isn't there. Blasted all to hell. He scans the crowd, looking for that meringue peak of silver hair. There. Is that him? No.
Akiva,
Dan says, laughing nervously.
You know, the planet you helped liberate?
Uh-huh, wonderful planet. Hotter than a bantha's belly, but just wonderful.
Still no Ek anywhere. He's taller than most here, so he lifts himself up on his toes and glances over toward Nimtar. The Quirmian is gone, and so is Condor.
I have to go, he says suddenly.
The young woman interrupts again.
If you have a moment, our mother would like to meet you and thank you in person.
No time.
You're not a very good senator,
Dan says, suddenly bitter. Sinjir bares his teeth.
That's because I'm not a senator, you bloat-headed buffoon.
He pushes between the two of them and heads deeper into the crowd. He's not thinking straight enough to be surreptitious, so he speaks right into the calm.
Hello? He says. Condor, where is he?
How should I know?
Jom asks.
Han, Tim, you got anything?
Neither of them answers.
Jom, what's at your location?
The commando answers.
Nothing. Everything's fine here. Rethalo's still in the depth chamber.
No suspicious characters? No shenanigans of note?
No. Where is everyone else?
I don't know. Sinjir winces. I lost Ek, too.
Bloody criffing hellstar, Sinjir!
Don't worry. I'm just as disappointed in myself.
He says nothing and gets moving, cleaving a hard line through the crowd of senators looking for Ashmeen Ek or Nimtar or Condor.
Please be all right.
And seeing none of them. He hops down off the farthest patio onto the Fibercrete street. He does a loop around the whole restaurant. He moves past the trash compactors out back, feet splashing in puddles from a recent rain. Then he moves up the other side of the building, down a narrow alley. There. Ashmeen Ek and Nimtar. The man from Anthon Prime is shorter than the Quirmian, and yet somehow seems to lord over Nimtar. Ek is seething.
He's got the long-necked alien by the scruff of his shirt, and with his other hand, he thrusts a smug, accusatory index finger up in the alien's face.
Sinjir begins to march right toward them.
Hey! Hey, stop right there!
He says before a plan actually forms in his head.
I'm not Security Bureau. What am I doing?
They turn toward him, looking like children with their hands caught in the sweets drawer. Ek's eyes flit to him, and then past him, as if... Sinjir hears the scuff of a boot.
There's someone behind me.
Something hard clubs him in the back of the head.
A white flash pops behind his eyes,
and it's lights out, even before he hits the ground.
Interlude, Coruscant.
Coruscant is in chaos, and Mos Amida is trapped. He's a prisoner of his own empire. Those few remaining here in the impenetrable Imperial Palace are keeping him to his quarters. He has not left in months. Those present are loyal not to him. No, they belong to another, to Gallius Rax, the true keeper of the Empire's fate and fortunes. Rax sent him a handwritten letter, a rare thing to see, something only Palpatine himself was known to do from time to time, when this all began. It said quite simply, "Glorious leader of the Empire, I have taken Jakku. I have brought the Empire with me. You are still its leader in name, but you will be confined to your quarters until it's all over. Do not try to leave. The doors are sealed, even the ones to the balcony, in case you entertain the idea of jumping. And any attempt to escape will be met with reciprocal violence meant to hobble you. I assure you, this is to keep you safe so that you may lead us again one day. With great honor and respect, Counselor Gallius Rax." What a pompous gas bladder. Rax was making no joke when he said he would hobble Amida given any escape attempt. Just days into his cozy imprisonment, he tried to assault the two guards outside his door. He broke a plate across one's head, threw a clumsy, telegraphed fist at the other. They handily dispatched him. Before he knew what was happening, a boot connected with his knee, and he went down on the floor. One grabbed that leg and gave it a twist. The tendons tweaked, and he couldn't walk for days. Even now it gives him some trouble, with lightning whips of pain going up from his heel and into his hips. Woe and misery. They bring him food, good food, not victuals fit for an emperor, no, but it's not gruel either. Most days he's alone, the exception being when they bring him those meals. He wondered at first why they didn't just kill him. Why would Rax want him around? Then they showed him, blaster pressing hard against the back of his head. A band of ISB agents forced him to record a holovid, thanking the troops for their service, thanking Gallius Rax for his military leadership, and assuring the Empire that victory would soon be theirs. They force him to do this from time to time, once every month or so. It is soul-crushing. He'd rather die. Though sometimes, that desire to find death is supplanted by something else. A parade of fantasies where he wraps his fingers around the neck of Gallius Rax and crushes the man's windpipe. For a time, he hoped that Sloane was his salvation. They had a common enemy. But Rax found a way to end her. Lured her to Chandrilla, where, as the rumor goes, she fell off a sky bridge to her death. And now, Mos Amida has nothing and no one. He looks around his quarters. It is filthy. He has not washed himself in days. The room's practically a midden heap at this point. Even his clothes are dirty. He would send them down the laundry vacuum tube, but that stopped working days ago. Instead, he sits. He makes tea. He stares at the wall. Inside this room, all is quiet and serene. Outside in the city, madness has taken hold. He can see it from his windows when he chooses to look. Once in a while, an explosion will bloom in the distance. Any time he opens the blinds, he can spy wreckage, usually Imperial. An ISB speeder or ship sometimes crashed into the ground, sometimes into a rooftop. When they bring him food, he asks questions. What is happening? Who is out there? Are we safe? The only answer he gets is that he can be assured that the Imperial Palace is impenetrable. Then the guard will say something along the lines of, "The city is fine and remains under ISB control." Which is a lie so obvious it's like an ugly nose. Everyone can see it, even the one who wears it. This is the best that Mos can figure. They have lost Coruscant. Given that he has not seen the New Republic ships, he wonders to whom it has been lost. Is there still an Imperial blockade in space? Or has the criminal underworld finally ruptured like a straining boil? Have the inmates taken over the asylum? He always warned Palpatine that curating such a close connection to the underworld and keeping them so near was a dangerous gambit. Mos Amida is a creature of law and order, a man of numbers, a man of rules. Cozying up to scum like that always bristled him. Though he never said much in objection, did he? The Emperor had his design. He did not brook dissent. He did not brook something so disagreeable as a dubious glance. Palpatine only accepted advice when it was asked for, and never before. The Empire. What a grand and malignant failure. A pile of waste. And Mos Amida is seated precisely at its pinnacle. He wants to weep, but he has nothing left. He sleeps for a time. Then, a noise. It must be mealtime once again for the prisoner. No, this sound is coming from the laundry vacuum tube? It's faint, the sound. A thumping here, the straining of thin metal there. A faint susurrus following. Ah, someone is at last repairing the damnable vacuum tube. Well, at least he'll be able to get his clothes clean once again. If he cares enough to bother. And maybe he doesn't. With that mystery solved, Amida again drifts off to sleep. That is, until another noise startles him awake. This time, when his eyes pop open, he discovers with bowel-clenching shock that he is not alone. He is, in fact, surrounded. Filthy urchin children form a half-circle around his chaise, and their presence confirms for him what he has long feared. His mind has been well and truly lost, and he is now enthralled to a very vivid hallucinogenic life. At the fore of this vivid delusion is a soot-cheeked red-headed boy, his lip cleft by a fishhook scar, giving him a natural sneer. Naturally, the child has a blaster. They all do.
Go on, do it,
Amida says drearily. The boy seems taken aback by this. He shares looks with the other five children. A girl with dark braids forming a crown on her head makes a sour face.
You want to die?
She asks.
Iggs, you hear this bugger?
The sneering boy, Iggs apparently, lifts the blaster.
Well, Nance, I suppose we oblige this leech and send him on to the next life.
He lifts the blaster, and it's then that Mos Amida begins to cry. The tears are not tears of fear, or hate, or rage. They are the blubbering, plaintive cries of a man set on the edge, but never allowed to come away from it, nor allowed to leap over its precipice. Here, finally, a release awaits. Even if this release is the dream of a sleeping mind, or the vision from a broken one. The blaster barrel, like a black eye, stares at him. One of the other children, a bug-eyed, angry boy, twists the mouth that sits in the center of his bulbous forehead and says to Iggs,
I don't think this is gonna work, Iggsy.
Ah, Criffit. I think you're right, Irk, the towhead says.
He lowers the blaster. Amida shakes his head.
No! It'll work! Just do it! Please!
He paws at the weapon, but the boy pulls it away in a taunting gesture.
What am I missing?
Nans asks.
Let's axe the monster before anybody hears us. We have to get back out, you know.
Look at him, Iggs says. He's not who we thought. This blue bucket of flab couldn't lead a fly to a stack of dung, much less the whole of the Empire. We pop him, we probably do him and the rest of the bucketheads a favor.
But children all look to one another, and seemed to come to the same conclusion with a series of half-shrugs and nods. Amida presses himself further into the comfort of the chaise.
What will you do, then?
Nan says.
I guess we haven't figured that out yet.
Who are the lot of you?
Iggs lifts his chin with pride.
Ankle Biter Brigade. Or part of it.
One by one, they identify themselves.
I'm Iggs,
the red-headed boy says. The girl with the braids?
Nans.
Bug-eyed Angri.
Ark Galarg.
A pair of Bith, who may be twins, or who might just be Bith who look like each other. Mos Amedha has a difficulty differentiating them. Name the other.
She's Huli.
She's Chuchins.
Winchins,
says the last, another human boy.
How'd you get in here?
Amedha asks them. The angry Urk says,
Laundry tube. We broke it. Climbed up. Big enough for a kid to get through.
How foolishly simple,
Amedha thinks. And then comes the mad irony that Imperial engineers and architects were very good at creating very narrow and very vulnerable spaces in their designs. He begins to wonder if they had rebel collaborators building in such weaknesses.
Help me escape,
Amedha says.
You must be a real dum-dum, Wenchin says.
Iggs waves it off.
Can't fit you down the vacuum tube.
I can get us executive access to the turbo lift. We just have to clear the hallway. We get to the lift, I can get us out of here. The hallway has three guards. I cannot overpower them as I have no weapons. But you have blasters. Help me escape, and I'll help you.
Again, the children confer silently, raised eyebrows all around. Urk leans in, staring with those big yellow eyes.
What's in it for us?
You're rebels?
Of a sort. We rebel,
Iggs says.
Get me clear. I can turn myself in. I'll give the Republic the codes to open the doors to the Imperial Palace. I'll tell them everything. I'll surrender the whole Empire.
Of course, Mon Mothma did not accept his surrender last time, but these children do not know that. Further, maybe he can offer more this time. Maybe he can do it right.
Please!
It's Iggs that finally nods and says,
Deal.
He couldn't betray us,
Urk says.
He's done for. I figure he tries that, they'll just lock him back in here. Look around. This lump is just a prisoner in his own chambers.
But we could die,
Nans hisses in his ear.
That was always on the table,
the boy says, a surprisingly stoic thing to say given his age. But Amedha fears this child has seen more than most Imperial bureaucrats ever have.
We die. At least we die with our hands free and not tied behind us. Let's get it done.
To Amedha, Iggs says in a low voice,
We're gonna get you out of here. But if you try to twist your way out and mess with us, I'll shove you so far down that laundry chute, you'll wish you were back here sleeping in your own filth again.
Deal,
Amedha says.
Deal. Now let's get you to the Republic.
Chapter 21.
The observatory's defenses made short work of the hut's caravan, but Gallius Rax can see that, regrettably, they failed to finish the job. Now night has fallen, and his quarry is positioned defensively behind pillar-like plateaus down in the valley. He flicks from screen to screen, watching. Sloane and someone else, some man he does not know, are behind the eastern pillar. Nima and some of her hut slaves are hidden in the shadow of the western plateau. The good news is that they're all trapped, pinned there by the turbo lasers. They could try to run, but they would end up like the rest of the caravan, smoking wreckage and tangled corpses. Rex remains down in the bowels of the Imperial base. The Sentinel stands in the corner, projecting images from the center of its hand. In walks Tesh.